Did any of you guys happen to have a chance to read the LA Times op-ed page yesterday? I'm guessing you probably did not, but on the off chance that you did, you might have stumbled across this article, The Lowdown on High Self-Esteem by Roy F. Baumeister. He's a professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State. Does low self-esteem lie at the root of all human suffering, failure, and evil? When I ran my first research study on self-esteem in 1973, that certainly seemed to be the case. Psychologists everywhere were persuaded that if we could only help people to accept and love themselves more, their problems would gradually vanish and their lives would flourish. They would even treat each other better. Not surprisingly, California led the way, establishing a task force for exploring ways to boost healthy self-esteem to solve personal and social problems. The task force members, like many of us, were undeterred by the weakness and ambiguity of the evidence suggesting a benefit in boosting self-esteem. We all believed the data would come along in good time. A generation and many millions of dollars later, it turns out we may have been mistaken. 5 years ago, the American Psychological Society commissioned me and several other experts to wade with an open mind through the enormous amount of published research on the subject and to assess the benefits of high self-esteem. So basically, this guy was picked by the American Psychological Association to be the lead researcher on the most comprehensive study of self-esteem ever undertaken. Here are some of our disappointing findings. High self-esteem in school children does not produce better grades. Actually, kids with high self-esteem do have slightly better grades in most studies, but that's because getting good grades leads to higher self-esteem, not the other way around. In fact, according to a study by Donald Forsyth at Virginia Commonwealth, college students with mediocre grades who got regular self-esteem strokes from their professors ended up doing worse on final exams than students who were told to suck it up and try harder. Self-esteem doesn't make adults perform better at their jobs either. Sure, people with high self-esteem rate their own performance better, even declaring themselves smarter and more attractive than their low self-esteem peers. But neither objective tests nor impartial raters can detect any difference in the quality of their work. Likewise, people with high self-esteem think they make better impressions, have stronger friendships, and have better romantic lives than other people, but the data do not support their self-inflating views. If anything, people who love themselves too much sometimes annoy other people by their defensive or know-it-all attitudes. Self-esteem does not predict who will make a good leader. And some work, including that of psychologist Robert Hogan in the Harvard Business Review, have found that humility rather than self-esteem is a key trait of successful leaders. It was widely believed that low self-esteem could be a cause of violence, but in reality, violent individuals, groups, and nations think very well of themselves. They turn violent toward others when they fail to get the inflated respect they think they deserve. Nor does high self-esteem deter people from becoming bullies. According to most of the studies that have been done, it is simply untrue that beneath the surface of every obnoxious bully is an unhappy, self-hating child in need of sympathy and praise. High self-esteem does not prevent youngsters from cheating or stealing or experimenting with drugs and sex. If anything, kids with high self-esteem are more willing to try these things at a young age. In short, despite the enthusiastic embrace of self-esteem, we found that it conferred only two benefits. It feels good, and it supports initiative. These are nice, but they are far less than we had once hoped for. And it is very questionable whether they justify the effort and expense that schools, parents, and therapists have put into raising self-esteem. After all these years, I'm sorry to say my recommendation is this. The leading expert in the world on self-esteem. After all these years, I'm sorry to say my recommendation is this. Forget about self-esteem and concentrate on self-control and self-discipline. Wow. Is that cultural heresy or what? Thank God he's got all that alphabet soup after his name or he'd be lynched by now. But doesn't it make some sense? I mean, the idea that if we just tell people to think they're better than they really are and to really just love themselves completely, I mean, who would have thought that might have turned out bad in any way? I mean, who could have conceived the idea that maybe if we just tell people they're wonderful, that that could have any negative consequences for the world at all? If only some ancient writer had thought of some way to warn us, if only one of the great saints had somehow invented a word that'd be useful and warning us away from the dangers of an overinflated self-esteem. Oh, wait. They did. In fact, they said, it is one of the most dangerous things in all the world to love yourself too much. And to think more of yourself than you ought can be the cause of your ruin. This week we're beginning a discussion of the seven deadly sins, and we're beginning with pride. Why pride? Because it has long been considered to be the worst of all the sins, the root. Most people are not familiar with the history of the sins. If you'll give me just a minute, I'll catch you up. Back in the 4th century, a monk named Evagrius Ponticus, they were named stuff like that back then, drew up the first list in Christendom of really a warning list of things to avoid. He had a list of 8 deadly sins. And he listed them in increasing order of seriousness. Gluttony, then lust, then avarice, then sadness, then anger, acedia, vainglory, and pride. And pride was the worst. Pope Gregory the Great shortened it to 7, combined vainglory and pride. And then Thomas Aquinas, one of the 5 greatest theologians in the history of the church, gave us the list that we now use today, which we recited before the meeting began. They disagree on a lot of things in their list, but they all agreed that pride was there and that it should have, if you'll pardon the pun, the pride of place in the list. So let's take a look tonight at what pride is, why it's dangerous, and how we can escape its wiles in our lives. And so before we go anywhere else, we're going to give you a synopsis of pride. Get it? Synopsis. I make even myself laugh. Okay. First, you need to understand that very rarely does any one word capture the essence of a thing. That's why we've got so many words in the English language. Pride is really trying to get at a cluster of an emotion that's sort of clustered by many words. It's bounded by many words that give us rise. Picture a Venn diagram in your mind. What we're talking about is sort of the common point of these. Pride, self-absorption, self-centeredness, conceit, hubris, arrogance, haughtiness. These words are the thing that we're talking about. The virtues that they distort are confidence, humility, satisfaction, and self-awareness. Now, this is very important. All of these sins, of the 7 deadly sins. Incidentally, one thing about the history that I realized while I was studying that I didn't know. They're actually not called the 7 deadly sins by the theologians. That's a name that we use in our society because it's got some zing, it's got some zip. It's a marketing name, baby. Bada boom, bada bing. What they called it, what Thomas Aquinas called it, and Pope Gregory the Great, were the 7 capital vices. And the distinction to them was important. Vices were things that gave rise to sin. Not necessarily sins in and of themselves. There were things that if you lived in their environment long enough would produce sin in and around you. And each of these vices is a perversion of a virtue, a distortion, which makes sense. Because sin is brokenness. It's not new stuff. It's busted old stuff. When the world fell, it didn't fall into a new dimension. It just became less than it was. When we fell, we didn't get transported to, you know, the 5th dimension. We just became less than we once were. We got broken. All sin is broken virtue. The virtues that are distorted, as I said, are confidence, humility, satisfaction, self-awareness. A lot of biblical stories about this, which obviously we do not have time to cover tonight. There's the story of Satan, who we're going to focus on in a few minutes. There's Adam and Eve, who bought the lie that Satan himself had fallen for. Did you notice that? Satan tried the same trick on them that he fell for, that pride would lead him down the right road. And so he told them, you will be like God if you do this. So Adam and Eve bought it and they decided to try and determine morality for themselves. To be like God, determining good and evil. Absalom, in the Bible, vanity was his downfall. Great story if you haven't read it. Nebuchadnezzar, I almost used that verse, that passage tonight in Daniel chapter 4. If you haven't read it, it's really, really powerful. Uzziah, who thought he could worship God in his own way and sinned against God by his pride and arrogance. And there's many biblical teachings about sin. Sin is just a very, very nasty customer. Pride, I should say, is a very, very nasty customer. When you look at the list, it's like, why would I ever do this? Look at what it can do to me and in me. As I said, we can't possibly cover all those things tonight. So instead, I want to hone in on one example from the Bible and then talk about some of the philosophical issues that are raised when we deal with pride. Ezekiel 28, starting in verse 11. Then this further message came to me, Ezekiel, from the Lord. Son of man, weep for the king of Tyre. Pause. So who's the prophecy about? Or it is a prophecy, it's not about the future. Prophecy is often about speaking God's opinion about current events, as well as telling God's knowledge of the future. So King of Tyre, is a prophecy to him or to Satan? Answer is yes. It's both. In the Old Testament, you frequently find the identification of evil governments with demonic powers. And you see hints of this in the New Testament as well, where Paul says, you know, our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities, against the rulers of darkness in high places. The prophet here is speaking of both the king of Tyre and of Satan. And the way he's doing it is by comparing the king of Tyre to Satan. Son of man, weep for the king of Tyre. Give him this message from the sovereign Lord. You were the perfection of wisdom and beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Your clothing was adorned with every precious stone, red carnelian, chrysolite, white moonstone, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald, all beautifully crafted for you and set in the finest gold. They were given to you on the day you were created, ordained and anointed you as the mighty angelic guardian. You had access to the holy mountain of God and walked among the stones of fire. You were blameless in all you did from the day you were created until the day evil was found in you. Your great wealth filled you with violence, and you sinned. So I banished you from the mountain of God. I expelled you, O mighty guardian, from your place among the stones of fire. Your heart was filled with pride because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. And we also read in Isaiah, how you are fallen from heaven, O shining star, son of the morning. You have been thrown down to the earth, you who destroyed the nations of the world. For you said to yourself, I will ascend to heaven and set my throne above God's stars. I will preside on the mountain of the gods far away in the north. I will climb to the highest heavens and be like the Most High. But instead, you will be brought down to the place of the dead, down to its lowest depths. What was it that made Satan, Satan? What was it that made the Prince of Darkness, the Prince of Darkness? How did God's right-hand man become God's implacable enemy? Pride. Pride. That's the only answer we find in the Bible. Satan convinced himself that he was better than God, or at least he was better than God's rules. And every other wicked thing that's happened in the universe basically can be traced back to that one event. Because of Satan's pride, he led us astray. And he was able to do so because of pride that he evoked in us. Pride was the downfall of the greatest of all created beings. And so it can be the downfall of any one of us as well. Pride is serious business. Not just for the reason of the list of things that I gave to you, but because pride, well, just think about it. What's so dangerous about pride? Well, pride, if there's a rule, pride says, I'm an exception. If there's a law, pride says, I'm better than that. If there's a leader, pride says, I'm wiser, I'm more insightful, I'm going to go my own way and do my own thing, and it doesn't really matter because I ought to be the leader anyway. Every act of wrongdoing, ultimately, that I can think of, in one way or another, can be traced back to an ingredient of pride. At some point, you have to say, I'm better than X, I'm better than Y. Otherwise, the chain of logic does not hold. If we can actually deal with this pride thing in our lives, we can become significantly better as people, as followers of Christ. So pride's a big deal. But the thing that I always start to think whenever I run down this road in my mind is pride altogether bad? In other words, is there ever a place for pride in my life? I just said that every vice is a twisted virtue. So what's the virtue hidden within pride? Let me throw you a verse here that most Christians are not aware exists in the Bible. They read over it, but they don't really register with them. Galatians 6, verses 3 and 5. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Each one should test his own actions. Then he can take pride in himself without comparing himself to someone else. For each one should carry his own load. Wait a minute. I'm very confused. On the one hand, you just finished reading me the riot act about pride. The greatest of all created beings became the infernal prince of darkness because of pride. And I'm supposed to take pride in myself? That's like juggling with grenades. It's just stupid. Unless maybe we're talking about two related different things by means of the same word. As often happens, in life when we're talking about the abstractions, like love. This is my favorite illustration of this, that, you know, when you can describe your feelings for a hamburger, I love hamburgers, the same way you can describe your feelings for your infant daughter, you realize the word is a very flexible word that doesn't mean the same thing in every situation. I love my daughter, but I don't love her with lettuce on top and, you know, swallowing her down. It's just not the same thing. And the same way pride here, pride means multiple things. Let's see if we can figure out what it is that Paul is saying here to the Galatians about pride by analyzing the passage. As I look over these sentences, I kind of see four underlying assumptions that really are required for this passage to make sense. The first is that self-deception is a bad thing. Self-deception is a bad thing. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. Implicitly, that's a bad thing. In other words, whatever the right kind of pride is, it cannot be founded on a misunderstanding of who we are, especially not a willful one. We've got to know who we are, number one. Number two, each one should test his own actions. That in some way, pride, legitimate pride, involves measuring ourselves against a standard. That it's not like self-esteem, where no matter what you do, hey, you're good, you're great, you're wonderful. I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and gosh darn it, people like me. It's not that. It's about actually evaluating your actions, your attitudes, your thoughts, your deeds against some external standard. Third, without comparing himself to someone else, the standard is not other people. This is where we really start to get into the distinction here. The standard is not other people. Then you can take pride in yourself, for each should carry their own load. The fourth principle that I see here is that when you've satisfied these criteria, when you have got an accurate understanding of who you are, neither too high nor too low. Also, we find this in Romans 12, 1 through 3. Each of you should evaluate yourselves soberly, accurately, rightly, according to the measure of faith God has given you. When you have a real understanding of who you are, a self-awareness, and you're measuring what you're doing against an external standard, and you're passing it, you're doing well by it, and you're not comparing yourself to other people, not worrying about, I got a 98, but David got a 99, therefore I'm miserable, I'm upset, I'm bad. Or I got a 98, and Esther got a 97, therefore I'm better than you, nanny, nanny, boo, boo. The external standard is, I got a 98. That's awesome. That's an A, that's an A+. I did wonderful. Is it an A+ here at Stanford, or is it like an A? Anyway, I did great, I got an awesome score, it's wonderful. The external standard. I'm not focusing on how she did. I don't care how she did. I mean, I'm happy for her if she did well, and I feel sorry for her if she didn't do well, but as far as how I feel about my performance, it's not linked to hers or to his. It's linked to how I did compared to an external standard, and it is right and good for me to take pride in that. I should feel good. I should feel wonderful because I did well. Now, this is a notion of pride that probably needs a new word for our purposes tonight. Because if I keep having to say pride in the positive sense and pride in the negative sense, you know, pride in the positive sense is a good thing, but pride in the negative sense is a bad thing. And if we keep talking about pride in the negative sense, it should get very confusing. So I'm going to propose that we keep using the word pride for pride in the negative sense, because that's how most of us usually mean it when we use it. Now, for pride in the positive sense, what would be a good word for that? I guess I could use self-awareness, confidence, satisfaction. I'm going to opt for the word humility. It might surprise you if you've not thought about it much before, but this is actually the most accepted definition of humility among wise Christians that I have found. Humility is proper pride. Humility is the virtue hidden within the vice of pride, sinful pride. And I'm going to throw you a few quotes, and then a few references from the Bible that may surprise you if you've not stumbled across them before. First, we got Philip Brooks here. The true way to be humble is not to stoop till thou art smaller than thyself, but to stand at thy real height against some higher nature that will show thee what the real smallness of thy greatness is. In other words, the way some people think about humility is humility is pretending I'm less than I am. Humility, oh, well, no, you shouldn't do that for me. Oh, no, it was, I don't really deserve that. Oh, no, you're probably better if you did it than me. You're probably better at that than I am. When you know full well, you're 10 times better at it than they are. But you just feel like they need to be humble. You crouch, you stoop, you get down low, and you pretend you're worse than you are. What's the problem with that? It doesn't produce real humility in you. Because on the inside, you're still saying to yourself, but I could kick his butt at this if I needed to. This is me doing it with... It's like the Princess Bride with her fencing, you know, and the guy's like, aha, one thing you do not know about me is I am left-handed. Aha, you do not know I am left-handed also. And they go back for it. It's this whole time on the inside. Even though you're losing, you're thinking, I could totally beat... I know this one guy. That's actually how I met his wife. They were playing ping pong one day. And she was a fierce competitor. She's very good at ping pong. She was going at it, boom, 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 boom. And he was just beating her by a smidge. And at the end, she's like, wow, you are like the best ping pong player I've ever played. But I almost beat you. He said, yeah, but I was playing with my offhand. And, you know, they wound up getting married. So just some tips for you in the area of relationships. I don't know what that's worth. But, you know, if you meet a competitive woman like her, that might be the right or you know, guy. But, the problem is you always know you could do so much better if you wanted to. It doesn't check real pride. The way to check real pride is to do your utmost, to stand at your highest, to bench your max, to go for the gold, and then find out if you got it or not. And then at the end of all that, to compare yourself against a standard that you will never really hold a candle to, which is God Himself. When you've given your all and then you realize how far short you fall, true humility will arise in you. Anything less than that will not produce the opposite of sinful pride. In fact, there's a lot of stuff in the Bible like this. Numbers 12:3 says that Moses was the most humble man on the face of the earth. Did you ever read that verse? You know who wrote that? Moses. Well, at least according to church history. It's not signed or anything. wouldn't that be awesome? I'm the most humble man ever. Signed Moses. Humble people can actually say they're humble. It doesn't bother them to say that if they're truly humble. It's an accurate self-awareness. Yes, I am pretty humble. And they don't think about the fact that they're humble much. They just are. And when they're asked, like, yeah, I am. I'm not proud. I really am humble. This is Moses, the most humble man on the face of the earth, who faced down Pharaoh, the leader of the mightiest nation on the planet. He walked right into his throne room and said, back down, buddy. Let my people go. That's the most humble man alive. The most humble man alive led a million squabbling, fighting, childlike people through the Red Sea and in the desert for 40 years. A humble man did that. A humble man was one of the most effective leaders of all time. Humility is not opposed to doing your best and giving your all and taking on the toughest job that you know you can do. And if there's no one else qualified to do it, or if you're better qualified than anybody else, standing forth and saying, I'll get it done. Humility is not opposed to that. Think about Jesus. Jesus was humble and lowly of heart, he said. Take my yoke upon you. My burden is easy, for I am meek. I am humble and lowly of heart. This is a man who walked into the temple and just started kicking over money changers. Not the money changers themselves, but their tables. Maybe a couple of them got caught in the act, too. Beat them out with whips. This is the man who stood up to the religious leaders and said, you're wrong. This is your area of expertise, Mr. PhD. You were wrong. And here's why you were wrong. The most humble man alive at the time did that. Humility is actually much more complex than we've allowed it to be. Try this one for size. Psalm 45, 1-5. Throw this up. My heart is stirred by a noble theme as I recite verses for my king. And it goes on, but it doesn't rhyme all the rest of the way. My tongue is the pen of a skillful writer. You are the most excellent of men, and your lips have been anointed with grace, since God has blessed you forever. Gird your sword upon your side, O mighty one. Clothe yourself with splendor and majesty. In your majesty, ride forth victoriously in behalf of truth, humility, and righteousness. Let your right hand display awesome deeds. In your splendor, ride forth on behalf of humility? What the heck is that? If that doesn't make sense to you, then maybe it's because you either misunderstand the word splendor and awesomeness and majesty, or because you have a misunderstanding of the word humility. I would suggest in our culture, it's probably the latter. I mentioned many wise people opt for this interpretation. The Weight of Glory by C.S. Lewis. He's got this amazing zinger in there. Perfect humility dispenses with modesty. Perfect humility dispenses with modesty. Chew on that for a while. It'll take you a while to tease it out. And if you think that's something, why don't you hear what his mentor, not literally, they didn't know one another, but the guy he looked to the way we look to Lewis for writing inspiration, G.K. Chesterton, Gilbert Keith Chesterton. With the removal of all question of merit or payment, the soul is suddenly released for incredible adventures and rewards. If we ask an ordinary person how much they merit, they become hesitant and instinctively modest. It's doubtful whether they merit 6 feet of earth, in other words, the ground you'll be buried in. But if we ask them what they'll take or what they're capable of enjoying, the sky's the limit. This gay humility, this holding of ourselves lightly and yet ready for an endless string of unmerited rewards, is the secret of humility. A secret that is almost too simple to grasp. In fact, humility is so advantageous and so practical a virtue that people suspect it must be a vice. Humility is mistaken for a vice all the more easily because it generally goes with a certain simple love of splendor which amounts to vanity. Humility will always, by preference, go clad in scarlet and gold. Pride is that which refuses to let gold and scarlet impress it or please it too much. That's humility. And just think about it. If all things are equal, okay, have you ever thought what Judas thought? You can admit it. It's not evil to say that. But have you ever just thought, Judas makes sense when he's talking about the fact that this woman comes and she pours like this insanely expensive perfume over Jesus' feet, over the most humble man alive. And he doesn't go, oh no. Yeah, please, don't. You shouldn't make such a big deal. He's like, that's cool. It's like when you get to take a ride in like this really sweet car, like a BMW Z3, like your friend's taking, and you're like, man, this is awesome. I love doing this. Oh no, I really shouldn't. I wouldn't want to be associated with that sort of car. That's pride. That's stinking pride that you won't get in there and just say, dude, this thing rocks. Low center of gravity. I'm hugging the ground. I'm zipping along. I love it. I wish I could have one. I can't afford it though. Too bad. And you move on and you don't think about it too much anymore. You're okay with it. Humility will just enjoy the pleasures of life that come their way. Oh, dude, I can wear a $5,000 suit? Sweet! Put it on. Humble people can do that. Proud people think they have to earn everything they get. Proud people worry about what other people are going to think about what they do. Humble people can take life as it comes, and as a consequence, tend to have a lot more fun. So we've got these two rival visions of pride before us. A pride that's based on an accurate self-assessment, an honesty about ourselves that says, I know who I am, here's who I am, and just take me as I am. And a pride, on the other hand, that's based on an overinflated view of self that thinks we're better than other people, that is nasty and obnoxious and just makes you want to punch someone in the face. How can we tell which, if either of these, we incline towards? What's a simple self-assessment that we can do? I've got a little self-test here. Test is the wrong word. Quiz. I don't have it for distribution. I'm sorry. I wanted to do that. Didn't have time. I'm just going to read these questions to you one at a time, and I want you to reflect on them. Just think. Make notes to yourself about thoughts, emotions, scriptures, memories they call up in you, and then take this stuff to heart. And when you go to bed tonight, when you wake up tomorrow, when you walk around classes, just think about it, reflect on it, and ask God to transform your heart by the power of His Holy Spirit in the areas that He points out to you. Okay. Bad pride, as I said earlier, is like you can do a Venn diagram. And I could do all those illustrations before, but you guys know what a Venn diagram is, right? You got a circle, the overlap is the point in between. The wrong kind of pride is basically the Venn overlap of self-absorption and conceit. In other words, a proud person thinks about themselves a lot and thinks a lot of themselves. Here's a good clue as to whether or not that is descriptive of what's going on in your head. It's a question I ask myself a lot. What percentage of your conversation time with your friends is devoted to making yourself look good? In other words, devoted to making sure they do not misunderstand you in some negative way, think less of you than they possibly could. How much of your conversation is defensive? How much of your conversation is devoted to self-justification? Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. Monitor your conversations. Most of us, side note, devote a ridiculous amount of time to clarifying what we just said so that other people will not think less of us than we wish they thought. It's a huge clue that there's a level of pride rumbling within you. Number two, this is kind of obvious, but do you think you're better than other people? I mean, do you really believe it? If you do, that shit, man, klaxons should be going off in your head. Not do you think I'm better at something. You should probably all think that about number things. Like, I'm better than you at this, I'm better than you at this, but it doesn't mean I'm better than you. Because you're better at this than me, you're better at X than me, Y than me. Even if I was better than you at every single thing. If we were to like say there's 6,345 distinct skill sets that a human being could acquire, and I get better than you on a standardized test on every one of those, It doesn't mean I'm better than you. It just means I'm better at you than everything. There's a huge difference between those two statements. What do you believe deep down inside? Follow-up. Do you think that your presence or success here at Stanford could not be replicated? How do I want to put this one? You realize there were a lot of people competing for your spot to get in here, right? You got in. They didn't. Your admission was a mixture of two things. Your competence, your success, your skillfulness, that's one component. And you should take legitimate pride in that. This is an external test which you passed. Yes, I got in. That's great. The other side is luck. There was a level of luck that got you in here. If you don't believe it, ask Desiree. She works in the admissions office. She'll tell you. There's really qualified people who get turned away all the time. There are people who get disqualified from Stanford or USC who get admitted to Harvard or Yale, and vice versa. The fact that you got in here is a combination of something that was your doing and was not your doing. Other people who did not get in quite possibly would be getting better grades than you are right now. Do you believe that? And can you accept that? Or is your identity so bound up in your presence and success here at Stanford that you can't? If it is, by the way, here's some diagnostic questions to help you realize how little of a deal this is on a cosmic sense. Can you name me one person who got a 4.0 4 years ago here at Stanford? If you can't, who can? Can you name me who the valedictorian was last year? Who did best? Who was number one ranked in whatever, however they do it here at Stanford? Who was top? Do you know? Then do not bind yourself so tightly to these things if you who are closest to them do not even know what's happened in the past. Do not allow your self-identity to become wrapped up in this. Do you whine? That's whine. Whining tends to indicate a level of expectation about how you ought to be treated. Whenever you've got an ought to in your life, how people ought to relate to you, that's a clue. If you're a whiner, you probably deal with pride at a pretty substantial level. Here's another one. Pride is very competitive. If another person's arrogance really bugs you, just gets under your skin, where you just can't, after you act with the person, you just can't sit down, you're going to the conversation. Probably, not necessarily, but probably, it's because their arrogance bumped up against something in you that did not like, they knocked the chip off your shoulder and you didn't know was there. It should be a clue that maybe the thing in you that's shooting back at them is not something you want there. In general, if you're a truly humble person, you can interact with an arrogant person and feel two things. Compassion. You'll recognize it. You'll say, you know what? That person's so full of themselves, they have room for no one else. I really feel sorry for them. And then you know what the other thing is? Nothing. Water off a duck's back. You just let it go. You're like, wow, they're weird. Oh well, gotta live my life. Do you flaunt your humility? Do you wear it out there? Have you ever met someone who's excessively publicly humble? It's annoying. Humility should be like underwear. Everyone should have it, and no one should see it. Okay? That's just a rule of thumb for life. Are you able to accept compliments without letting them go to your head? Now, this has got two components. A, can you accept compliments? Can you actually take someone saying something good about you? And not be like, Like, if one of your relatives is like, hey, you got in Stanford, that's great. Oh, can you actually accept a compliment and say, yeah, I know, it's wonderful, and I'm really excited. Be honest. That's great. And can you not let them go to your head? That's tougher. Actually, let me take that back. Depending on your personality, one side of this equation will be tougher than the other. And whichever side it is, doesn't matter. The fact that you have a problem with it means that you've not achieved a state of true humility yet. Truly humble people can accept compliments and cannot let them go to their head. If you wonder how to do that, by the way, have you ever heard of Corrie Ten Boom? Anybody heard of her? Amazing lady, survivor of the Nazi concentration camps. She was helping to save Jews, and it's just an amazing story. You can read about it in a book called The Hiding Place. But she's gone on, I believe she's dead now, but for a while she was doing speaking after that about just God's work in her life, some amazing things. And she said this, you just collect roses, the praises and compliments during the day. You hold them, put them together in a bouquet. Then at the end of the day, you get on your knees and say, here, Father, these were yours all along. I just held them for you. That is one way that she's found of being able to accept compliments and not let them go to her head, realizing that they're all ultimately due to something God has done in her or through her. and giving it back to him as worship, which is a powerful act of worship. The final diagnostic question. Did you feel that none of these questions applied to you? If so, you probably have a problem. And I'll leave you to work through that. I really wrestled with how to end tonight, with what to do, what to say, how I wanted to do this. What I've come to is simply this. I'm going to pray. I'm going to throw up a poem. In fact, go ahead and throw the poem up right now. You've probably seen this. This is one of my favorite poems of all time. It's probably in my top three or four. Ozymandias by Shelley. Percy Bysshe Shelley. Is it Bysshe or Bysshe? How do you say his name? Percy Shelley. That's him. Percy B. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look upon my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away." You may not know this, but Shelley actually modeled that after a real statue. It's pictured there. It's the Colossus of Ramses II, Pharaoh of Egypt, I think around 60 BC or so. I'm not sure about the date. Do we remember who discovered fire? Do we know who invented the wheel? Whatever you attain in this life will pass away. Whatever you do will pass away. If you boast, the Bible says, boast in this, that you know the Lord, that you understand God. Anything else is going to pass, even as this universe passes away into nothingness. When we've been in heaven 10 trillion years, all the things that we got caught up in right here on earth are going to pale into insignificance, seem so small and so meaningless. I would encourage you now to begin to adopt that heavenly perspective. Pursue the humility that allows you to enjoy and explore life while at the same time holding the things of life loosely. In particular, holding rivalry with others, competitiveness, concern for other people's perception of you lightly. If you do that, you will be a vessel in whom God can do great things. Every person I've ever seen greatly used of God who has endured has been a truly humble person who was willing to excel at the things God had made them to excel at and was able to hold success lightly and not fret when it seemed to disappear from them. Join me in prayer. Father, compared to you, what do we have to be proud of? You're smarter than us. You're stronger than us. You created us. You were here before us. You really are better than us. I mean, between us, it's like superficial differences. Between us and you, it's a category difference. You're a radically different order of being than we are. You're self-existent. We cannot even conceive of all that means. If we were to study you for a trillion years, we would still not understand you completely. Fill us with a true humility, God. Not a false, fawning, obsequious humility, but one that is founded in an accurate perception of who you are and who we are in comparison to you. A righteous pride. Lord, that's the cry of our heart. Each of us wrestles with pride in different ways. Speak to us individually about what you would do in us to break us free of pride. Of the area in our life where pride presses most harshly right now, show us what we must do to move to the next step. I'm going to pause for about 15 or 20 seconds while you pray and listen to God and see if he speaks anything to your heart. God, continue to speak to us tonight, tomorrow, the rest of this week, as we go about our daily task. Help us to notice the instances in our lives when we are filled with pride and allow it to govern our thoughts and our actions. Convict us by the power of your Holy Spirit. We ask in faith, in Jesus' name. And everyone said, Amen.